This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Today marks 75 years since the attack on Pearl Harbor. Back in 1941, as the country grieved the attack and prepared for war, many people worried about their safety, especially on the West Coast. Meanwhile, Duke and Oregon State were scheduled to play the Rose Bowl in Pasadena, California, but in the wake of the bombing, the football game was moved to Durham. It's the only Rose Bowl ever played outside Pasadena. In his new book, writer Brian Curtis tells the story of the young men who first met as opponents on the football field and later as allies on the front lines. He also told the story of that game. The book is called Fields of Battle, and Brian Curtis joins me now. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you so much for having me on.
My pleasure. Again, the only Rose Bowl ever to be played outside Pasadena. Take us back, because the teams had been chosen before Pearl Harbor, but tell us the story that led up to the decision to move it to Durham.
Well, the two opponents, Duke and Oregon State, were announced on December 1st, and life went on. They were selling tickets to the game in Pasadena. Oregon State is the champion of the Pacific Coast Conference, was officially the host team of the game, so they were organizing the game and selling tickets out of Pasadena. Pearl Harbor gets bombed 6 days later on December 7th, and preparations continued for that Rose Bowl game. Both teams continued to practice for the game, but almost immediately there were questions about whether or not the game would go on. You started to see it in newspaper editorials around the country, from the Los Angeles Examiner and the New York Times and even the Charlotte Observer, the precursor to it, which was, on the one hand, we must play the Rose Bowl game. If we don't, we're further giving in to our enemy, the Japanese, by stopping our way of life, and sports is exactly what we need. On the flip side, you had those who said, let's put this in perspective. We are now officially in World War II. Many of these young boys who are playing in the game will be going off to war. This is their last Christmas at home. And staging a game with tens of thousands of people in Southern California could be a danger, and the Japanese could easily bomb it. So this debate went on for about 6 days. Ultimately, it was up to the military. And John DeWitt, who commanded the 4th Army on the West Coast and the Presidio in San Francisco, ultimately on Saturday the 13th asked the governor to cancel the game. They did. Almost immediately, there were offers to host the Rose Bowl game in Louisiana and Chicago, Memphis, Washington, D.C. Duke University, as one of the participants and coached by a very powerful and legendary figure at the time, Wallace Wade, said, we can host the game here. And with some logistical help from local schools, they put together a plan. And within 2 days of the cancellation, it was announced that indeed the Rose Bowl would be played in Durham, and it was given official sanction by the Tournament of Roses. And that's how we came to this historical footnote of the only Rose Bowl game not played in Pasadena.
And your book points out, I think as you read it, a lot of the differences between then and now, among them just sort of how this game was organized. I knew about this game, but I was a little surprised that Oregon State gets to pick their opponent, and they picked Duke, right? Tell us more about that.
Well, through the evolution of the Rose Bowl game, the first tournament East-West game was played in 1902, and that was between Michigan and Stanford. Michigan was beating Stanford so badly that they called the game in the second half. It went another 14 years before they could find a West Coast team that was willing to play a team from out east or the Midwest in 1916. That was actually Brown versus Washington State. And so over the next 20 to 30 years, there were different changes of how the teams were selected. It just so happened that in 1941, when Oregon State was a huge underdog in the Pacific Coast Conference, shocked the world, really, and won the conference on the last day of the season by beating rival Oregon, the policy at the time was that the champion of that conference would pick its opponent. Well, Oregon State certainly wanted an opponent that could help sell tickets and wanted to play a good team. The number one team in the country was Minnesota as part of the Big Nine Conference, the precursor to the Big Ten, and they prohibited their teams from participating in postseason bowls. There were other teams under consideration like Texas A&M and Missouri and Fordham. Ultimately, they chose number two Duke, who was undefeated at the time. And contrary to most people think, going to a postseason bowl game was not a given, no matter how well you did. It often depended on the whims of the faculty at a university who made the decisions about whether or not they would allow the kids to participate. In this case, they did.
Well, tell us more about that, because that's one of the other big differences between then and now. Bowl games were not that popular at universities. As you said, there were universities that held their students out.
Yeah, I believe there's 40 or 41 bowl games now. In 1941, there were only four, and the Rose Bowl game had long been the only one. It was joined 4 or 5 years earlier in the mid-1930s by three other bowl games. But, you know, some of the issues that we hear today, Frank, in the arguments over college football are the same ones that I found in my research 75 years ago. Criticism that players are spending too much time on football and not enough on academics. Criticism that the game is dangerous with concussions and injuries. Accusations of schools paying players. In fact, at both these participants, Oregon State at Duke, at one point in the late 1890s, early 1900s, the faculty shut down football because of all of these concerns. So these same concerns were there in 1941. We're still talking about the same ones in 2016. But
then you had 40 schools to say, no, our players' academic time is so important, we're not going to let them play in bowls. I don't think there are many universities now that will keep their students out of a bowl game.
I think it would be very hard today. I think 10 years from now, we'll see a lot less than 40 bowl games. But I think the business side of it is just so large now with the television revenue and ticket sales that it would be very hard to convince someone to turn down that kind of money just because of academics.
All right, let's go back to 1942 when this game was played in Durham. So what was the reaction of the players, particularly in Oregon? You're going to a place called Durham, North Carolina.
Well, that's true. But remember, Oregon State College, it was not a university at the time, those boys had not been all over the country. Some of them had certainly been on a train, but just a local train, never been on a plane before. Just the fact that they were playing for a Rose Bowl championship, obviously they would have preferred Pasadena, but they were okay going to Durham. In fact, the highlight of the whole Rose Bowl experience for many of them was the first-class train accommodations from Portland across the country to Durham. On Duke, on the other hand, many of the players felt disappointment. Remember, Pearl Harbor had already been attacked, so many of them thought they were going to war. They didn't know much about Oregon State College. This was not a huge, big national brand coming into town. Many of them wanted to spend Christmas with their families. They wouldn't get a chance to visit the movie studios and the movie stars and the beaches of Santa Monica. Some of them wanted to use the four complimentary tickets to the Rose Bowl game and sell them for some extra cash. So as I write about in Fields of Battle, the team overwhelmingly voted against playing the Rose Bowl game in Durham against Oregon State. They were fine if that game never even went on. After Wallace Wade gave in and promised them 5 or 6 days off at Christmas, he was able to get enough players to say, fine, coach, we'll play it. So there was much more enthusiasm on the Oregon State side than there was on the Duke side, and I think that played out as evident by the game.
Well, yeah, because Duke was really favored, a huge favorite in that game, and didn't turn out that well for Duke.
They were 3-1 favorites. They were faster. They were bigger. They had a better offense, a better defense. They had a more prolific and storied coaching tree led by Wallace Wade. But yet it was rainy and muddy. It slowed down Duke. There were sloppy turnovers. In the third quarter, Oregon State had a 68-yard pass reception for a touchdown, which at the time was the longest Rose Bowl touchdown pass in history. And Oregon State upset Duke 20-16, which really shocked a lot of people. It didn't shock the Oregon State folks who believed all along that they could beat the mighty Dukes.
So the story of the game itself is a pretty incredible one, but Fields of Battle also tells the story about the players and the aftermath, a lot of individual stories. Let's start with the story of Jack Yoshihira, who played for Oregon State.
Jack had come to America at a very young age. I believe he was under 2 when he came with his mom and sister over from Japan. They lived in Portland. His parents began a restaurant in the Japanese section of downtown Portland. He went to an American public school. After school and on the weekends, he would attend Japanese school, as many of his friends in what was known as Japantown did. He matriculated to Oregon State, was a student, a full-blooded American, practiced with the team, was not a major player during games, but did get into most of the games that 1941 season. Of course, after Pearl Harbor, there was a lot of racial hatred and anger sent to the 42 Japanese Americans on campus at Oregon State, and Jack did suffer some of that, but he was beloved by his teammates and friends who treated him no different. They continued to practice for the Rose Bowl game, and then a few days before they got on a train, some FBI agents came on the practice field in Corvallis, spoke to his coach, Lon Steiner, and then pulled Jack off and explained that he was now considered an enemy of the state and could not travel more than 35 miles from his home in Portland, so he would be unable to make the trip. Within a couple days, his teammates and student body president, Andy Landforce, rallied to his defense. They submitted a petition to the president of the university and then to the campus ROTC commander, whose response was, "Gentlemen, we are at war and the president's orders will be carried out." So Jack Yoshihara, sadly, waved goodbye to his team on a train platform in Portland with a tear running down his cheek, would end up listening to the Rose Bowl game on a radio, finished out the spring semester of 42 before he and his family were forced to sell all the belongings, shut down the restaurant, and by August of that year was in an internment camp in Idaho. Yep. And Jack, you know, it's a sad story, but I also think it was an important part of this. He was a member of the team for years and decades after. There was a lot of resentment from Jack and his sons and daughters towards how he was treated by America, which we can all understand. I guess if there's a positive end to this story, he was finally awarded his Oregon State degree about 5 or 6 years before his death, was given a Rose Bowl ring, and his family actually 3 weeks ago came to the 75th reunion that Oregon State hosted in Corvallis, which was a really neat and emotional night.
Well, your book also follows the lives of Charles Haynes of Duke and Frank Parker of Oregon State. And again, I think this surrounds the story about how many of these young men really wanted to get off the football field and into the battlefield.
Frank Parker was a player for Lon Steiner at Oregon State, very poor child, was working jobs as logging around rocks and picking up garbage at the age of 12, went to Oregon State, got on the train, went to the Rose Bowl game, played in the Rose Bowl game. On the opposite sideline was Charles Haynes, middle-upper-class family, about a mile from Duke's campus in Durham. Father worked for the American Tobacco Company. Didn't play a lot for Wallace Wade, but played enough. Haynes would end up entering the Army and serving with the 88th in Italy. Frank Parker entered the Army, went over to Italy in July of 1944. Haynes had already been on the ground for 5 or 6 months fighting by the time Parker got there. They struck up a conversation and realized that they had been opponents on this famous and infamous day, January 1st, 42, in the Rose Bowl. So Parker and Haynes served in different companies, but right alongside each other, and fought alongside each other. In early October of 44, near the Po Valley, Haynes charged up a hill leading his platoon, was shot and wounded and left to die. It was too dangerous for fellow soldiers to get to him. After word got back to Frank Parker that his buddy Charles Haynes was dying and wounded, Parker risked his own life and, with another soldier, ran up the hill, picked up Haynes' body, got him to a medical tent. Haynes eventually survived and was back on the battlefield in a few months. They said goodbye to each other at the end of the war in May of 1945 and never saw each other again for close to 50 years later at the 50th reunion of this Rose Bowl team in Corvallis, where Charles Haynes and his then-girlfriend made the trip across. Of course, all these men were in their 70s by that point. And really, it's a poignant story, and I thought that they should be main characters. They weren't necessarily the stars or the MVPs, but it embolizes what these boys were. They were innocent boys that played in this unique football game as opponents and then ended up on the same team, wearing the same uniform, fighting a world. And, of course, I also follow both Frank and Charles and the other characters home after the war. And it's interesting to me how they fought in the same battles, killed a lot of Germans, each of them, many of them in hand-to-hand combat. Frank Parker struggled the rest of his life with dealing with the demons of war, while Charles Haynes went on with life as if he hadn't even fought in a war.
Talking to Brian Curtis about his book, Fields of Battle, today on The State of Things. A lot of the young men who played in that game, a high percentage actually did go off, and there's four of those who were killed. There's poignant stories about their Rose Bowl rings. Tell us that.
Well, these players had the ability, were even given or bought rings shortly after the Rose Bowl game, and it was inscribed with the score and a red ruby symbolizing the red rose, and then, of course, their name on the side, similar to rings that Champions of Sports gets today. Well, you know, many of these players left for war within days, weeks, months after the game. There were four players who participated in that Rose Bowl game who were killed during the war, three on the Duke side and one on the Oregon State side. And in my research, I was able to get the military files that are now declassified. And in that, for those that were killed, it lists the possessions on their body. And in multiple cases, the only possession these boys had on them was that Rose Bowl ring. And it was really poignant to me because it stood out about just what that game meant to me. It was a little slice of home, of what being an American meant, that these boys carried on their fingers. And whether they died from a sniper getting off a boat in the South Pacific, one of them was shot on patrol in Iwo Jima, others drowned. Very sad, out of the 80 players, that four of them lost their lives. But these rings just meant so much. And even in talking to the sons and daughters and grandkids over the last year or two researching this book, they all talk about the rings that their father or grandfather had.
Well, Brian Curtis is the author of Fields of Battle, Pearl Harbor, the Rose Bowl, and the Boys Who Went to War. Brian, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
You can find out more about his book and appearances at our website, stateofthings.org, and you can be part of our show. We're working on our year-end special, Favorites from 2016, and if you have a moment, a segment, or a show that was your favorite and want to be on the show, let us know, sot@wnc.org, or tweet us at #SOTMoments. State of Things, produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton Ormond, Katie Barron, and Laura Pelliser. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stasio.